This is a MacKillop podcast. Welcome to Exploring Curiosity, Resiliency, and Hope, a podcast for times of challenge and transformation. We are excited for your presence as we learn, grow, and evolve from a multitude of voices and wisdom. This is a space for conversations and curiosity, finding ways to be resilient with all that is happening in our personal lives and the world, and maybe finding an embodied hope to live by. We join our host, Trevor, in conversation with Reverend Sean Sanford Beck, who is also known as the Green Priest.
It's normal and okay not to succeed all the time. You know, and for eldest children who are used to pushing through and being overachievers, sometimes just sort of getting sat flat on your ass and knowing that you're totally useless at a given task, like, it's actually okay. It doesn't mean that you're not a beloved child of God. It doesn't mean that you're incompetent. It doesn't mean any of those things.
Sean has been living off-grid near Murray Lake, Saskatchewan, but has just joined St. Andrew's College in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, as the college's student recruitment officer. He is the founder of the Ecumenical Companions of Sophia, an informal web of spiritual seekers looking for wisdom. Sean is an Anglican priest, as well as a Christian druid, who connects with the deep energy of nature while holding traditional Christian beliefs. He has written a book exploring this entitled Christian Animism. We were in conversation with Sean just before he moved into the urban life again.
Well, Sean, welcome to the podcast. It's an honor and a privilege to have you part of the conversation and to share your wisdom and your life experience today. As we start today, what would you like people to know about you, just to get a picture and a feel of your energy?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, first of all, I'm glad to be with you, Trevor. I'm glad we finally made this connection. So I am, right now I'm calling myself an ecumenical priest. I'm in a sort of a transition zone, so I have to invent some of my own titles, and I've chosen ecumenical priest. I was ordained Anglican, so I've been an Anglican priest for quite some time, but I've stepped out of the Anglican world and am moving back towards my United Church roots, but I'm not a United Church minister. So right now, I just call myself an ecumenical priest. I'm an animist, and that's something that we'll probably talk a little bit about. I'm also a member of the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids, which is an international order of druidry. I'm a father and a husband, and right now I am a homesteader as well. So we live off the grid on the shores of Murray Lake, just north of the Battlefords in Saskatchewan. So right now, when I look out my window, I see the lake, which is starting to freeze over, but still opens. The water's flowing right now. The gardens have all been sort of put to bed. The harvest is done. We got our oats all brought in. We do that by hand. Do pretty much everything by hand, actually. But also, even my geography right now is in a bit of transition, because we've been out here doing this off-the-grid homesteading for about 7 or 8 years, but in the process now actually of moving back to Saskatoon. I just got a new position at St. Andrew's College, the United Church Theological School, I'm the new recruitment officer. So if there's anybody out there interested in theological studies, send them my way. So that's a little bit of sort of who I am, just in a bit of a nutshell, sort of a transition zone right now in many ways.
Yeah, it sounds like you're in the liminal zone.
Yeah, which is always where creative things happen, I know, and yet not being a very patient person, can be a bit of an awkward place from time to time.
It is, and in some ways, I really resonate with what you're saying, that you're in the liminal zone, and what a breadth of experience you have. We could just go so many places with what you shared in this first part. I mean, homesteading and, I mean, talk about life experience. I mean, just with that, what have you learned about, you know, curiosity and resiliency in living off the grid?
Well, I realized we've had some big learnings. I mean, obviously it's way different than anything I've ever experienced. I grew up in the country, but not off grid. I grew up on an acreage. We weren't a farming family, but you know, I had country experience. So when my wife and family and we started talking about sort of exploring off the grid life and back to the land, I was sort of like, oh, I'll be fine with that. That's, you know, I'm used to that sort of thing. And Janice, who grew up in the city, I thought she would be having trouble with it. It turns out that actually one of the first things I discovered is that I'm not a gardener, nor a very good farmer. I ended up becoming much more of a city boy and a book boy. And so really being out, you know, where we have to haul all of our water out of the lake and filter it for all of use. We have to, you know, cut and chop the wood. We don't have any heat other than wood heat for cooking or heating. We have a little bit of solar power, but not too much. And when you've got five people in a household competing for solar energy use for all their computers and devices, it can be a bit of a bloodbath at times. You know, so all of those pieces, those were big learnings that made me recognize very quickly some limitations on what I thought I could do. And then, you know, once I hit walls of limitations, all of a sudden I really had to change my expectations. So it's been, for me, a story of growth through struggle, I think, this past 7 years. Yeah.
Did you ever lose hope in those 7 years?
There were times, I think, when I would experience some real lows, that would let, you know, I'm used to in my life being a bit on the melancholy side anyways, but there were times where there'd be sort of a couple of weeks at a time where it would just be, yeah, I wouldn't say loss of hope, but where hope, the embers of hope grew a little bit dimmer than I like in life. So yeah, but not full loss, yeah. I don't think.
Okay. And as you look back now, did you learn something about those times, or what did they teach you?
Yeah, well, I think one of the main things is just that it's normal and okay not to succeed all the time. You know, and for eldest children who are used to pushing through and being overachievers, sometimes just sort of getting sat flat on your ass and knowing that you're totally useless at a given task, like, it's actually okay. It doesn't mean that you're not a beloved child of God. It doesn't mean that you're incompetent. It doesn't mean any of those things. And if there's a way to just breathe through it and be patient with that state of failure from time to time, there's actually a lot of growth that can come from that. That's what I've found. Yeah.
Wow. That, you know, that's really simple what you're saying in some ways, but it must take some work to find that place to accept, you know, falling on your derriere.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's been a lesson in humility. And I don't mean to say that the whole time has been like that. I mean, there's been lots of really beautiful and interesting and positive things about living on the land like this, but it also there's a lot of humility inducing things too.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's a real letting go of control in a way.
Yeah.
to live on the land. What drew you to try this as a family?
Janice and I had been talking about it for a number of years, and we'd sort of gone back and forth on it. And usually when one of us was really sort of secure in our job, the other one would be yearning to try something new and vice versa. But finally we hit this point in time where we were both sort of at the same place. We were both saying, yeah, this is the time to try this. And we had gone out to the farm where we live, and we're not alone on that farm. This is somebody else's farm. So we met the people who were on this farm. We got to know them like just really quick over the course of an afternoon. And we just sort of fell in love with the land. Both of us sort of said to each other on the drive home, we said, we should talk to them and see if we could come and sort of pitch tent in their and form an eco-village with them, that sort of thing, you know. And the neighbors were the folks who own the land and farm here. They were willing to take a risk and give it a go and said, yep, come on out. There's another house you can live in. Let's see what happens. And so that started sort of our 7-year adventure of just trying this thing. It was a bit crazy. Lots of people thought we were crazy. We tend to do sort of adventurous things in our lives, not free fall skydiving or anything, but just we've always sort of made decisions that maybe don't make sense to a lot of people, but we just figure life is too short. You got to try some things along the way.
And was there anything like from what was happening spiritually for you or other things in your life that sort of had that yearning for you guys to try this 7-year, I don't know if you call it an experiment or not, but this 7-year way of living?
Yeah, well, both of us have always had a real interest in spirituality and ecology. For Janice, it's very much about food growing, food security, you know, the spirituality of food production. For me, it's been much more about relationship with non-human people. So the winged people, the tree people, you know, the beings on the earth that that we often don't notice, or if we do notice, we tend to notice them as natural resources rather than as our relations, our cousins. So we had both been, you know, we had deep roots in that that sort of eco-spirituality. And when this opportunity came up, we decided, okay, it's time to really give this a try and see if we can put some flesh of experience on the bones of theory, so to speak.
So you were talking about the winged creatures and the you know, what people in our province of Alberta really look at natural resources in the worst way.
Yeah,
sometimes
we do too. So Saskatchewanians are just as bad.
Okay, yeah, and so this ties, if tell me if I'm not following this way, but this ties into your journey with Christian animism then too.
Yeah, definitely. The Christian animism piece was something that was growing in my mind for quite a while, especially as I was engaging with various forms of neo-paganism. So that's been a sort of a dialogue partner for me, has been Druidry, Wicca, other forms of sort of contemporary earth-based spirituality. I've been sort of reading about them, you know, studying them for a long time. And one thing that kept coming out was this sense of, you know, the living earth and spirituality as a way of connecting with a whole myriad of creatures who have sentience, who have personality, who have their own lives that they're living. So that piece about animism, I played with mentally for quite a while, and then I realized, you know, this is actually something that could work with Christianity. You know, Christianity has had a long history of sort of bad-mouthing animism because it tends to confuse it with idolatry. It tends to confuse relationship with other creatures with worshiping other creatures. And I realized once you break that link, once you realize that animism isn't actually about worshiping anything else, it's about relating, deeply relating to other living beings and honoring them, I realized that could have a really powerful place within Christianity. So I did a lot of work, did a lot of reading and study, and then I ended up reading or writing this little book called Christian Animism. It's sort of the first, I'm proud of it because it's the first published work that actually tackles this subject, that names this issue. There are some other folks who are now starting to write more about it, and there are some Facebook groups of people devoted to this topic, but you know, it was sort of neat. It was the first one to break ground with that.
And how would you from like your book sort of define Christian animism?
Well, it in some ways it's a straightforward definition. I'll sort of read a bit of the passage where I define animism and Christian animism, and then maybe I'll unpack it a little bit after I read this. So I write in the introductory chapter. I find that animism is a useful term set in the context of a worldview which sees spirit as the interiority of matter rather than its dualistic opposite. Animism can be reclaimed as a concept which sees the natural world as sentient, personable, and very much alive. It helps us to experience and understand each created entity, from a prairie gopher to a Rocky Mountain range, as a person, someone to whom we are related. That is basically what I mean when I use the word animism. Christian animism, then, is simply what happens when a committed Christian engages the world and each creature as alive, sentient, and related, rather than soulless and ontologically inferior. However, that's not really simple, is it? This type of stance vis-a-vis the natural world would have enormous implications for all aspects of Christian belief and practice. What would liturgy look like, for instance, if we knew that plants, animals, and whole ecosystems were co-worshippers with us? How would our eschatologies change if we had to make room in heaven for the entire created order? Would our ethical processes morph if love your neighbor now included cows, plankton, and all manner of creepy crawlies? And what does pastoral care look like for trees, anyways? All of these and more are questions which a Christian animist perspective must engage. So that's sort of how I define and introduce Christian animism just a little bit there. And it's that type of definition builds on this really important animist scholar named Graham Harvey. He defines animism like this. He says, the animist inhabits a world that is filled and teeming with persons, only some of whom are human. And I just think that's an interesting way to look at the world, that it's filled with persons, only some of whom are human.
Yeah. It reminds me of moving our I guess consciousness or how we relate to the world from object to more subject to subject.
Definitely, yeah. And I mean, Buber had it right when he talked about the I-thou relationship rather than the I-it relationship. I think a lot of people thought he was talking just, you know, in metaphors when he talked about his relationship with the trees. But in reality, that's, you know, we're talking about real relations, not just metaphors.
Yeah, as I was listening to you, but also in preparing for this, and also after reading your book, I'm really keenly aware when I look at the Christian sacred literature, we call it scripture, but of the little places where there is this theme that you've talked about. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, like in Job 12, chapter 12, you know, that's a story of hopelessness for a while.
Right.
One of the questions is asks, but or said, it says, but ask the animals and they will teach you, or the birds mm-hmm. of the air and they will tell you, or speak to the earth and it will teach you, or let the fish of the sea inform you.
Yeah.
I mean, is that fitting into what you're talking about?
It definitely is. And the wisdom literature, especially of the Hebrew scriptures, the wisdom literature portions like Job, like the Psalms, like Proverbs, even like some of the apocalyptic passages, all of those do present images of the world very much alive and able to interact with us. And I think it's, you know, part of it is our imaginations have tended to be captured by a view of the universe that's very mechanistic. And so when we read passages like you just read from Job, or when we read from the Psalms that the trees clap their hands and the hills jump and skip like lambs, we read those as if they're metaphor, as if, mm-hmm. you know, the scripture writer couldn't actually mean that, like, because obviously nothing else has souls except for humans. So we read it with those blinders and we think, you know, this is just a poetic fiction. Whereas I actually think the scriptures are describing something foundational about how the cosmos actually works and who is part of the cosmos.
And then what I hear you, which I find delightful from my perspective, is that if I hear you right, the implications or what you're saying is that there are spiritual and experiential moments where you can actually hear the trees clapping.
Yeah.
For instance.
Yep. Yeah, and I think there are spiritual disciplines that allow us to hear and speak with the living earth and its beings more clearly. I think there's types, forms and types of meditation that help us cleanse our imaginations, I think, and free our imaginations, so that as we hear those sounds of nature, they actually translate for us into actual words, or if not words, at least strong perceptions of communication. Some people describe feeling emotions from not only animals but also plants and ecological features in the landscape. Some people do this in terms of seeing visions of these beings. Other people actually do hear voices. So I think there are ways we can be more open to have those conversations with the other persons that inhabit this world.
So living on the land, have you had some of these experiences with the persons that are in your backyard or
yeah.
the lake? Have you, what's it like?
Well, to be honest, it's both awesome when it happens, but because I'm also, very much formed in typical, you know, Western scientific materialism, it's also a bit jarring too, because part of me goes, oh, did I just imagine that? What's mm-hmm. going on there? Did it,
yeah.
you know, am I starting to lose a bit of mental stability here? You really start to question it. And yet if you can push past some of those questions and just sort of trust a little bit, I mean, it really is quite awesome. I have a circle of trees in the backyard that I call my grove, and that's where I will often go to do meditation and to do prayer. And I will often pray for the land that I live on. And sometimes I can feel so strongly those trees right around me that it feels a bit like, you know, when you're sitting in church and you're praying, but you're very aware of the people next to you, even if your eyes are closed, you just know they're there and they're praying with you. I have had many times that experience with the trees of my grove, where all of a sudden it just feels like we're all a congregation together, you know, praying for the wider landscape. It's pretty cool. It doesn't happen all the time, but like I say, there are, when the imagination is open to it, it does happen more often than you would think. Yeah.
It reminds me of sort of that consciousness development where we move from pre-rational to rational to post-rational. And in a way, when I hear you talk, I hear that these spiritual experiences are not pre-rational, like, you know, metaphor or mythic or magical, but they're a post-rational experience of the living world.
No, that's what it feels like. And like in my, when I say feel, I can almost sometimes feel it in my body. I can almost sometimes feel that shift of where the rational mind sort of drops down, one, like an elevator going down a bit. It sort of drops down into the heart, and that's where the post-rational kicks in, you know, where, and it doesn't, it, for me, I don't know how others experience this. It doesn't leave the rational behind totally. That rational is always there, but it quiets it. It sort of puts it to the sideline a bit and lets a whole other realm of perception and experience come into play. Yeah.
What do you feel in our Christian heritage and lineage that we're sort of coming out of the shadows of empire and Christendom, where any of this talk, and maybe you've experienced this yourself, would be called wouldn't be orthodox, heretical, burn at the stake.
Well, and I mean, I must admit, I've had, you know, I have had fellow clergy accuse me of not just heresy, but you know, demonology. I've been questioned sort of by house of bishops at different times. I mean, people get really nervous about this stuff. I'm a systematic theologian, so I'm actually very careful in how I explore some of these topics. But it just seems to me that animism is a valid, like a theologically valid path, even within Orthodox Christianity. It's just a path that hasn't, that's been forgotten. And I think because it's been, animism has been a foundational part of some of the other spiritualities which Christianity and Christian empire have just rolled over and totally decimated. I think animism has been collateral damage of that sort of full frontal attack against other forms of green and indigenous spirituality all over the world.
When I read your book and listened to your interview on Tapestry, I was enthralled because it's something that it actually warms my heart, my own personal experience too.
Yeah.
Like you, I grew up in the country, and for me, I don't know about yourself, but I find it really hard not to lose great hope what's happening to our planet right now.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't, what is your experience if you see the trees and the soil and the creepy crawlies as persons, you know, the whole land, what's your experience of what's happening to our world ecologically, environmentally these days? And how do you find hope to somehow that we might be transformed of a human species to live in greater harmony?
Well, I mean, I think my hope comes in from several different streams. One is the understanding that we brought about a lot of these destructive changes by a huge shift in worldview. Probably right after the medieval era in the West, we shifted into this heavily mechanistic worldview. And it has caused intense amounts of damage. But part of me draws hope in the fact that worldviews do change. Ways of understanding cosmology do change. And I think we're on the cusp of a change out of the mechanistic world into much more of a holistic and organic and animist way of viewing reality, certainly a much more holistic way of viewing reality. I think those worldview shifts are hopeful because if we've created the problem, we may be able to create some of the solutions. So that's one stream of hope. As an animist, the other stream of hope is recognizing that humans, I mean, we've done tremendous amounts of damage, but we're not the ones who are going to, by ourselves, save the world. There's a redemptive agency within each and every created being. So I sort of think of it like that, you know, the first phrase of the United Church, the new creed, you know, where it says we are not alone, we live in God's world. And by that I experience that not just that God is in the world and so we're not alone, but also the world is filled with a teeming number of other persons, right? So the forests themselves are not just standing idly by burning, you know. In times of crisis, they go deep into their roots. And then when you, after the fires, you see them regrow. And it's amazing, you know, multiple species, they're not just passive victims of human domination. They have agency of their own. And so when I see us, myself and us, as partners with multiple other resilient species and persons, never mind the ancestors and the nature spirits, you know, like that's a whole other story, but there's this whole, the scriptures call it the host of heaven, right? I see that as the host of the green earth and of heaven, you know, we're not alone in trying to sort of resist the forces of empire and domination. So sometimes, yes, it feels like we're getting our butts kicked and the world is going to hell in a handbasket. But I think in the hidden realm, it's the story isn't over. And that's where I draw a lot of resilience and hope from that.
For yourself personally, what type of practices do you do to have that, to find that hope and that resiliency and to build these relationships with all the non-persons? With all the what we call non-persons,
right,
like
yes.
With all the persons out there.
Yes, we in animism we call it the other than human persons or the more than human persons. So I think there's a few ways to start. So one, okay, in fact, I'll sort of talk about three different ways. I mean, one is simply, it's about transformation of the imagination. And I guess there's nothing simple of that, but it's cultivating a second naivete, a childlike wonder in the world that helps us get out of the mechanistic way of seeing things and really intentionally finding ways to allow that childlike wonder to come to the fore. So that's one piece of it. And people go about that in many different ways. There's also the ethical piece of it. So figuring out like how our lifestyles can actually become more in harmony with the greater Earth community. I think people are starting to catch on to some of these things. They're things like, you know, buying less, being less consumeristic, looking at where their food comes from, looking at where their energy comes from, like making some concrete changes, both as individuals, but also as communities and also politically too. So there's getting involved in those ethical ways of being that help put us more in touch with the living earth. But in terms of spirit, what might be traditionally called spiritual practice, here's what I would recommend. Begin to see your surroundings, and that may be your garden out in the backyard. That may be your farm if you're out in the rural area. That may be if you're a city dweller and you walk through a park to get to work, maybe that park is your green surroundings. Begin to see that as your parish, and that you are a priest of that parish. But your parishioners are all of the creatures that live within that green space. And people need to define that green space for themselves, but define it, like actually put some boundaries on it so that it's an actual location for you that you visit on a regular basis, on a daily basis, and begin to actually pray for that place. Begin to pray for all the creatures that you see. Begin to talk to, you know, and I guess if you're in a city, you got to be a bit careful because people might, you know, send the guys in the white coats after you. But begin to communicate with the creatures that you find in your parish. And if you don't hear them right away, that's okay. Just keep speaking and keep listening and keep praying. And I think that over time, with that type of sort of spiritual commitment to that place, that you will actually notice things starting to change. You'll notice things in a different way, because you're introducing yourself to all your relations in a very real and practical way. You know, Indigenous folks often will talk about the earth and the earth community as in some ways just waiting for us to notice them, like, and wondering why we go about, you know, as if nothing exists except humans and their technology. So
do you think they're getting impatient with us?
I sometimes wonder, but my experience is that every time somebody begins to make this journey and start communicating, that there's a sense of joy, you know, a sense of, okay, here's another one who's learned how to talk to us. That's great, you know.
So do you think the more than human persons maybe vibrate, if that's the right word, or have a communicate at a slower frequency than us humans that seem to want to go faster and faster? And does it require us to slow down too?
I think so. I think slowing down, so I would use a bit of a different analogy. The slowing down helps us clear some of our static. If we're talking about frequencies, you know, and thinking about as an analogy of a radio frequency or a television frequency, slowing down helps us clear our static. I think actually what happens, other types of creatures have frequencies that are both lower and higher than ours. I think the problem, you know, because for instance, rocks have a very low frequency, and it's very, their speech is very slow, just like, and trees too, their frequency is a lot slower and lower, whereas hummingbirds and winds have high frequencies, right? Yeah. The problem for us is that we move so fast that we're used to static filling all of our frequencies, and we just think of that as normal. So spiritual practices that help clear away that static help us then increase our own range of receptivity to different frequencies. And I think what happens is, you know, on a cosmological level, I think what happens is spirit speaks to spirit. So the spirit of the tree speaks to my spirit, and then somehow my imagination can translate that spirit to spirit speech in a way that my mind can understand. Mm. That's what I think is going on.
It reminds me of I study the non-canonical texts.
Right.
Because I think they have something to teach us.
Yeah.
And so like the Gospel of Mary Magdala, which we don't have the full text of, but she talks about the imaginal.
Yes, yes.
So that she actually sees the risen Jesus or Christ imaginally.
Yes, yes, definitely.
And the risen Jesus and Christ is really alive and present. But there's they call it the nous, the heart sees imaginally.
That's right. Which is, and we in the West especially, we're not used to that category. We're used to the category of imaginary, by which we often mean not real, right? I mean, people are, it's just your imagination. But the imaginal is this, it's this realm in and of itself that I think exists in the borderland between body and spirit. That it's its own realm that we access through our imaginations, but it's not imaginary in the sense of not real. It's just more real than what our senses can usually deal with.
Yeah. And do you think part of it is the process of this type of awakening? It's probably for everybody, but does it require sort of unhitching or maybe including and transcending? There's lots of terms for it, like one's lower self or one's ego or idealized self. Like there's a way that maybe that's the static or noise that prevents us from having these relationships.
I think so. I like, and I'm not sure who used the phrase first. It may even go back to the Celts, but the sense of cleansing the eyes of the heart. It's wiping clean the lenses of our emotions and imaginations. I think it does have to do with decentering the ego, if not totally detaching. I don't know if we ever detach from the ego or the lower self, but at least decentering it, and allowing the eyes of the heart to be cleansed by the spirit. Yeah.
And so when you're out on the land, mm-hmm. your land or the land you're sharing with your neighbor, mm-hmm. what does it feel like when the eyes of your heart are cleansed in a moment for you? Does it come upon you suddenly, or are you surprised, or sometimes what does it feel like when that happens?
Sometimes it's a total surprise, because I may be thinking about something very different. I may be thinking about what's for supper, or how much wood I need to bring in for the fire that night, or whatever. And all of a sudden, boom, a squirrel sort of natters at me from the tree right there, and all of a sudden we're in this conversation. Sometimes it's a surprised by joy type moment. Other times it comes within my regular practice. If I'm down getting water at the beach and I do a blessing of the water, I'm sort of open and expecting that there will be some communication. Sometimes it doesn't happen, but oftentimes it does. And so there's this it's not as much of surprise at that point. It's more like when you go knocking on your neighbor's door and lo and behold, she opens the door and you have a little conversation, It, in some ways, it feels very natural. It just feels like you've come home to your neighborhood that's now filled with more neighbors than you ever knew you had.
Just listening to you, I feel like I want to slow down.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm remembering growing up in the farm and going visiting a neighbor, and they invite you in and you have a coffee.
Yeah.
And then often in the old days you get a treat too. Like, there's this communion.
Yeah.
I mean, does it feel Eucharistic since you're Anglican? Is it a like Teilhard de Chardin's Mass of the World for you?
It does feel like that. It really does. And again, not all the time. Like there are times when that is sort of hidden from me. But there are moments where it just sort of breaks through. Like, for instance, when I'm doing a water blessing, I actually have a little chalice that I use, and I as I lift the water up, and say the blessing before putting the water back into the lake, I'll take a sip of it and I'll offer it to the, you know, the guardian of the lake, the lady of the lake who is there too, and it feels like we are having communion together. Similar when I'm in the grove in my backyard and sitting at a little rock which I use as an altar, I'll feel like some of the different presences come, and it's just like we're sitting around almost like a campfire. Even though it's a rock, it has that feeling of we're sitting there together and just sharing each other's company, as well as communicating with each other about, like, what's going on in the land, what might need prayer. Because for me, this is happening in the context of daily prayer. So as I sort of hear from these other beings, there's sometimes a suggestion of, you know, we need to send some good healing energy out to that quarter, or, you know, the lake needs a bit more energy, good energy today. So, you know, and I know not everybody will experience that type of thing. This is probably because I'm a priest, so I just, you know, I sort of work in that ways. But I think it's a call to all of us to exercise the what, you know, we've called the priesthood of all believers. In some ways, I think it's the priesthood of humanity. Maybe if humans do have a unique role in creation, maybe it's not dominator. Well, I know it's not dominator. Maybe it's not even steward, which implies a sort of a management role. Maybe it's actually priest. You know, maybe our best attitude is one of prayer and intercession and pastoral relation with all of these other persons in our parish.
And for you, how would that influence all our, I like to call them our human systems that seem so divorced from the world, the nature and the cosmos? How would that change all our human systems that seem to be in a rut and a mess right now, and some type of transformation, but it feels really dark?
Yeah. Again, I think it's we don't act on behalf of things and beings that we don't love. And we don't love beings whom we don't know. So I think that's sort of an obscure way of saying that as we come to actually know and love intimately these other beings, places, ecosystems, trees, plants, we begin to take all of them into consideration when we're making decisions within the human world. Now, how much, I mean, there we're back to, well, how much does any given individual have influence over the systems of domination that we deal with, right?
Oh, yeah. Tell me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like in Southern Alberta here, it's hard not everybody's this way, but for myself, not to get personally sort of, I call it, not to go into rage, but, you know, they're wanting to reopen coal mines.
Yes, I know.
Crow's Nest Pass that have been closed, I mean, since they've been protected since 1976. I mean,
yes.
That's a whole,
yeah.
Talk about a whole bunch of, I mean, it's just, I don't know, I sort of quake.
I know. So, I mean, something really practical, though, that I think might be a way to, that we, especially for non-Indigenous folks, I think it may be really important for all types of reasons, but especially for this type of reason, for us to begin to really build strong alliances with Indigenous people because they've been fighting these battles for so long. And you talk about resilience and knowledge and innate connection with all our relations. Like, Indigenous folks will be our teachers. And if we can find some way to come alongside them in the work of resistance that they are doing, to save, you know, to save and protect their own lands, I suspect that will be the way, you know, we can have the most impact, is simply by standing beside our Indigenous sisters and brothers. And that's not always straightforward. I mean, I remember going up to the tar sands and going and visiting with people in Indigenous communities. And of course, where there's oil money, there's all types of different opinions and conflicts. And that goes right into Indigenous communities as well as non-Indigenous. So I know it's not always straightforward, but I do think if we're going to put our activist energies and our animist energies into, you know, world protecting projects, we need to do it alongside Indigenous folks.
It's really slowing down and building a lot of relationships.
Yep.
With what we've called non-persons, including our First Nations siblings.
Yep.
By the Christian tradition, we're called non-persons, essentially.
Yep.
Which allows you to do terrible things, just like calling all our winged creatures and furry creatures non-persons allows us not to love either.
That's right. Yeah.
And it seems like in our Christian lineage, to me, it's like when you read some of the stories or iconography of the different mystics, from our lineage, they seem to have that connection innately with nature.
Yeah. Well, especially when you go back, I mean, for me, a big piece of this whole journey has been rediscovering the Celtic saints.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a form of spirituality that was in some ways, and I want to be careful the way I say this, but it was in some way Indigenous to Europe in the sense of it was earth connected in our homelands, so to speak, in the old country. So when I look to those eras and to those figures, it gives me hope. You know, you talk about hope and resilience. It gives me hope to know that it once was like that. Perhaps it can be like that again. I think it's no surprise that the current Pope, I don't follow Roman Catholic stuff, you know, really closely, but I, you know, as an ecumenical person, I'm always sort of watching that he, you know, by taking on the name of Francis and by making, you know, ecological awareness one of his first priorities in his reign. I mean, I think that's really significant. I think the fact that the various ecumenical bodies have adopted a season of creation, you know, that's something that's happened in the past decade or so. I remember when people started talking about that, some bishops that I knew just laughed at it. They just thought it was the craziest of ideas. And now it's part of our liturgical calendar. I think awareness is really growing. But going back to what you said about the mystics, Francis, Francis of Assisi and his sense of relationship with the entire creation. Think about Hildegard too.
Yes. I was thinking Hildegard.
Yeah, her amazing, I mean, she was a herbalist and a healer. Some of her stuff described the healing properties of rocks and crystals, things that, you know, nowadays people just would sort of write off as, you know, New Age fluff or whatever. I mean, this was her bread and butter. It was really close to her heart as she led her, the nunnery at the Benedictine Foundation that she was in charge of. So I mean, those are strands of our tradition that I find really life-giving if we can hear those voices again.
So as you're getting ready to move back to the city,
yeah,
what's that like for you?
There's a lot of grief about leaving the farm, because there has been so much, so many relationships developed here with the other than human person. So one of the things I've been doing over the past month or so, and will continue to do, is really saying goodbye to the creatures that I've come to know. So there's real grief there. There's also a real sense of gratitude for what I've learned, and a knowledge that that connection is not going to be fully broken. There, I'll be, visiting back to this part of the country quite frequently. But there's also an excitement of going to the city, partially because it's starting new work that I'm really looking forward to and enjoying already. But also, the city is not devoid of these other than human persons. In fact, the city is teeming with them. We often think the city is something other than nature, and I think that's an illusion. You look at the amount of green space that many cities are preserving and even increasing. That's a good sign. You look at the resiliency and tenacity of wildlife, who especially if there's a city that a river runs through, it's a wildlife corridor. You look at all the little green things that push their way up through the concrete. So even in the city, we are not alone. We live in God's world, and that world is full of all types of, green neighbors just waiting for me to re-engage with.
Are your other than human persons giving you any wisdom or challenges as you leave? Or as you're not there on the same consistency?
I do sense, and I don't want to project, because I don't want to project my guilt, but I do sense there's some degree of disappointment. But I also get a strong sense of just acceptance. I think one of the things I've learned from more than human creatures and persons is that they ego isn't quite their issue like it is for us. There's much more of a Tao, of a what is, what shall be, change. The world is change, and that's just part of reality. So, I think I'm taking that as a bit of a gift. I experience it as a forgiveness in leave taking. But I think it actually just as a whole, maybe a whole, what I would call a holy detachment that that other than human persons have.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to us or share with us in this conversation?
Lots of things. I mean, we could go in so many different directions. We've just sort of scratched the surface on some of these things. But I would say, you've brought up the element of hope several times. My biggest thing would be to keep coming back to this sense that we are not alone, right? That for me, that's just been it's been a sanity saver, a life saver. Not only is the Spirit of God present and working towards healing of the earth, but every person, human and otherwise, is striving towards that as well. And the transformation is coming. You can see it happening in many different ways. Pay attention to those green shoots of new life, because the transformation is coming.
That is really hopeful.
I hope
I
so.
really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Well, it's so easy to lose hope sometimes. You might, we don't have cable TV, right?
Right.
I've never had it actually my whole life, but we have the internet and you can, what do they call that? Doom scrolling now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's a
I
big
don't know.
thing.
And maybe where you live out there with less power and less time and bandwidth. You might limit. Does your family limit that sort of exposure?
We do. I mean, we certainly have it, but it has to be limited. So, you know, we try not to waste what we do have on the doom scrolling, because it doesn't really go anywhere.
I mean, when you move to the city, you might have a lot more access to the technology that speeds up and puts noise in front of the eyes of our hearts.
It could, yeah. I mean, that's going to be a challenge for sure. And you know, going into new work, while it has its many joys, it can also be a bit distracting from some of the spiritual learnings that I've that I've gained over time. So the challenge for me is going to be trying to keep my ears and eyes open, keep the eyes of my heart cleansed, and make sure I find that daily walk to go on and start introducing myself to a new parish.
Have you touched base with your ancestral lineage that flows in you?
Yeah, I have. And this is something that's been fairly recent. I'd never really thought much about ancestors before, but again, because I kept hearing it from sort of indigenous friends and neighbors, how important ancestors were, I thought, well, okay, what's this all about? And so when we first went out to the farm and I started really running into trouble in terms of challenges and limitations, I all of a sudden became very aware of grandparents, my grandparents who had been on the farm and who were good farmers, right? So that was one, and I sort of had a strong sense that they were, if not cheering me on, at least giving me gentle support. You know, that opened me up to thinking about, what are the spiritual lineages of ancestors that we carry? And of course, as settlers, that's a complicated history. We know what some of our ancestors were involved with in terms of the colonial project. And so, one of the things that I've been trying to work on, and in fact, I wrote a fairly extensive piece recently, on how we can go about extending the apology, you know, the church's extended apology to residential school survivors. How do we go beyond apology to the survivors and their descendants and actually apologize to the ancestors that were wounded by our ancestors? How do we, I think somehow spirit extends backward and forward in time, and there's something about doing ancestral work that needs to be a part of our reconciliation practices. I don't quite know, frankly, I don't know what that looks like, but it's been coming to me lately that this is another piece of work that we need to start thinking about and figuring out ways to practice that.
Yep. For myself personally, I've come to realize that I carry the gifts of my ancestral lineage, mm-hmm. and the power of it, but also the woundedness.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, to heal that is it's just another part of the healing process.
Yeah, yeah, it really is, and I think it's something that we're invited to do as individuals, but also as a culture, right? Like, so one of the things I've been working on a lot is I'm writing with a really good friend. My best friend and I have been working on a prairie reinterpretation of the Anglo-Saxon rune poem. I don't know if you're familiar with runes, but they're, the sort of that, the old Scandinavian and Germanic alphabet system that have meanings attached to them. So we've been working with the Anglo-Saxon version of that, with each rune sort of and the poem that goes with it, the ancient poem that goes with it, being sort of like a unit of spiritual cultural DNA that we've inherited. And that together those runes somehow speak to what is deep within our cultural DNA. Trying to figure out, like, what is it that makes us who we are? So for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, how did we get here? How did we both carry incredible gifts into the world and become probably the worst bullies that the world has ever seen? Like, what happened somewhere along the way? What happened with our ancestors that made us who we are? I remember William Stringfellow's a influential theologian down in the U.S. who influenced Walter Wink a lot with the first work on powers and principalities. And Stringfellow wrote this book called My People is the Enemy. And that's, you know, that phrase really resonates with me. What does it mean for my people to be the enemy to the flourishing of life in so many places, as well as being gift bringers too?
What sparked your curiosity in this episode? Do you sense a resiliency that was hidden before? From the conversation, where is hope leading you? If you are enjoying this podcast, please subscribe, consider rating it, and sharing it with family and friends. This podcast is produced by MacKillop United Church. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for the generosity of all of our donors. If you want to support this podcast, go to patreon.com or macKillopUnited.ca/donate. Peace and blessings to you.